Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. According to the National Center for Education Statistics, only 3% of tenure-track faculty in the United States are Latina. The numbers of tenured and tenure-track Latino faculty at elite universities is even smaller. And this despite the fact that Latinos comprise nearly 19% of the population and are the fastest-growing ethnicity here in the United States. Afro-Latina professor and scholar of Latinx studies, Lorgia Garcia-Pena was among the most beloved teachers at Harvard University, where she served on faculty from 2013 to 2021. But she often found that the simple act of teaching class subjected her and her students to scrutiny and surveillance by campus police.
While I was at Harvard, beginning my first year, I developed a course that I call Performing Latinidad. And it's a performance class. It had an active component, a workshop, if you will, where students were working groups, building a performance together based on class material. I would usually invite a performance artist to train them and to work with them. So over the years, it became such an important thing for the Latinx community on campus that people across campus would email me and look forward to when is the annual performance? When are your students doing this thing on the yard? Every single year, there was some sort of incident. The first year, we were getting ready to have class outside and to practice our performance, and someone called the Harvard campus police and reported us and said that there was a group of protesters on campus. So the assumption was that a bunch of students of color couldn't possibly be students of color. And so, okay, that happened the first year. This is 2014. It continued to happen every single year of my teaching. So I would take many steps. I would reach out to the dean of the college and to the staff person in charge of events and make sure that they knew that my students enrolling in Performing Latinidad will be on the Harvard yard and we will be doing this or that, and give them a route and tell them where we're going, where we're walking, what we're doing. No matter how many steps I took, somebody always called the police. The police will always come and harass my students and harass me, including my very last semester teaching. And there were two moments that were particularly violent. One was in 2016. This is right before the elections. My class decided that the theme for the performance would be taco trucks in every corner of the Harvard yard to kind of think about the politics of the moment. And it ended up being a beautiful performance, and students engaged, even the tourists that were around joined us in the procession. And sure enough, we had campus police show up and harass some of my students who happened to be undocumented. And it was very traumatic. Then as I was walking home that day to my car, two guys threw a cup of hot coffee at me while yelling, "Build a wall." So This is happening on campus, and I don't know that the university did enough to protect me or my students. My last year in 2019, again, while teaching the same class, before the performance even happened, as we were setting up, my students were harassed by the Harvard police, and they went to get me in my office. I ran. I was like, I cannot believe this is happening again. How is this possible? They questioned whether the police questioned whether I was a professor or not. I had to show ID. It was a really drawn out and traumatic day for my students. This is a week before or so I was denied tenure.
Help folks understand who are not in the academy. It's funny. I have a 20-year-old daughter who was born when I was an assistant professor, and during her whole life, she's heard me talk about first trying to get tenure and then, you know, doing tenure reviews and all that. And apparently her whole childhood, she thought I was saying the words 10-year. And she was, oh, what, tenure? That's a whole different, what are you talking about here? So for folks who don't know the weird world that we live and work in, help people understand what tenure is and how it's used by institutions to convey who is and is not valuable to the institution.
tenure, in theory, it's a very unique system to academia, which basically means it guarantees employment for life. You cannot be fired from your job unless you break the law or you do something really terrible once you get tenure. And so the process to obtain tenure is lengthy. There are three stages. There's the assistant professor, which is usually a newly minted PhD, and then associate professor, which it's for most people is when they receive tenure, and then the holy grail, right? The full professor. And in the process, tenure is meant to protect academic freedom. It is meant to allow scholars to write and to teach and to speak about difficult subjects without fear of losing their job, meaning criticizing the state when necessary or corporations. In reality, the way that tenure operates at this time of age is as a reward system. It is something that is vested upon some faculty, the minority of people in the university who do the teaching. And it is very much convoluted with political, economic, at times, ideas of what the university should be, how the university should operate. And consistently, it is a process that is harder for scholars of color, particularly women of color, and for scholars who are in interdisciplinary, less established fields.
You were denied tenure by Harvard in 2019 in a denial that became extremely public because it did feel so shocking. Can you talk to me a bit about that experience and how you come to a place where you can describe it simultaneously as violent and edifying? Because I might have to say you better than me, because I don't know that I would be in a place where I could use the word edifying to describe that.
What was edifying about the experience of being fired by Harvard via tenure denial was the way in which a community emerged out of that. A transnational, very large community of people who think about the work that my work wants to do in the world as necessary and frowned upon this violent result. And so it taught me a lot about what really matters in terms of the work that we do, both out and in the classroom. I didn't ask students to protest. I didn't ask people to write for me, and yet they did. And they expressed their outrage. And in that process of their own outrage, I was held, and it gave me strength. And so as hard as that was, I got up the next day and I said, I'm going to write, because this institution does not own me and does not own my work. And I don't need them to tell me that my work is worth it. And so that was the lesson that was in there somewhere, but that it became really visible for me in very tangible ways.
We reached out to the Harvard University Police Department for comment, but had not received a response by airtime. They get back to us, we'll post a statement on our website. When we come back, Professor Garcia Peña will talk about her new book, Community as Rebellion.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll talk with psychologist Jonathan Haidt about his book, The Anxious Generation.
We're overprotecting in one place, and I'm saying, lighten up, let your kids out. And we're underprotecting in another, and I'm saying, don't let your kids spend 9 hours a day on the internet talking with strange men. It's just not a good idea.
Jonathan Haidt on the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
We're continuing our conversation with Professor Lorgia Garcia Peña. After a high-profile tenure denial from Harvard University, Professor Garcia Peña accepted a tenured position at Tufts University. There, she's working to transform her classrooms into being what she calls communities of rebellion. And she's authored a new book, Community as Rebellion, a syllabus for surviving academia as a woman of color.
We talk in academia so much about decolonizing the university, about making changes that are structural and lasting for all of our students. But I believe that the most significant change that we can make and the most lasting and the one that as faculty and teachers, we have control over is the classroom. And that begins with what we teach and how we teach it. And so I wanted to invite people to think about not only the things that we cannot do as faculty and the challenges that we face, particularly as faculty of color, but the kinds of changes that we can make for our students to create spaces of freedom within the classroom. And to me, that begins with the syllabus and how we think structurally about what we're teaching.
Like any good syllabus, your text opens with the course requirements. And you see the course requirements are four: an open heart, a flexible mind, the desire to be part of the sum rather than a single part, and patience. This is, on the one hand, exactly how a syllabus opens: course requirements, the readings that you will need, the aids you will need for learning. But you have framed them pretty differently. How is it that an open heart, flexible mind, the desire to be part of the sum, and patience can lead to this freedom-inducing academic space that you are building for us here?
The ability to think of ourselves, of our students, of the classroom, of the people that make up the community in any kind of university or learning center, for me, it's really critical that we think of ourselves as whole people. Think of not only what we're reading, what we're expecting students to write or to produce, but about the kind of experiences, lived experiences that they're bringing into the classroom. For me, the most important thing I can do in the classroom for my students is to make them feel safe. Once they feel safe, then learning happens. And to feel safe, you have to feel like your person, your whole person is accounted for. So in thinking about this book is a very personal narrative that begins with my experience, with myself. So I'm asking those of you who decide to enroll in this course to keep an open heart, because I am opening mine for the readers.
And when you say it is personal, begins with your own experience, it truly does. And in a place that I feel like every colored girl will understand, you begin with your hair.
Yes, I do. I was trying to think about what rebellion has meant for me. I was talking to my mother and my aunt, and they were reminding me of how challenging I was as a girl when it came to my personal grooming and what they thought was acceptable for Black girls' hair. And I come from the Dominican Republic, a country that has become known for its hairdressers and hair making and hair doing. But the translation of that is mostly hair taming, right? And transforming beautiful kinks into straight hair. And so as a child, I resisted that. And it didn't come from a place of political engagement. It came from a little bit of laziness and resistance to what was the process of sort of tightening my kinks into these coils. And so I was remembering that as I was talking to my mom and my aunties about how that was sort of my first sight of rebellion. Nobody touches my hair. Nobody does anything to it. And I walked around this girl with this gigantic afro and making a lot of people uncomfortable. And so I thought that would be a fitting place to start talking about rebellion.
So how do we build, as you describe them, communities of rebellion?
The first thing and the most important is to create spaces where people feel safe to speak up. And when it comes to teaching, that begins with the syllabus. That begins with who we are including and who we are choosing to leave out It also means bringing a lot of sincerity and openness to how you engage with students in the classroom in particular, or to people in a community you're trying to create. I start my classes by sharing how uncomfortable I am in the university and in academia, and how I have learned to embrace that discomfort as a sort of barometer that tells me that I'm doing something right. And I allow students to create from their subject position, from where they come from. And so to begin to build communities, and that means in the classroom, that means in your neighborhood, that means in the company that you work in, it's critical that you bring sincerity and that you allow spaces where people feel safe, where they're not going to feel judged, where they're allowed to express themselves openly. And that means doing. We need to rethink how we define community. And what I propose in the book is to think about community, not as a noun, but as a verb, to commune. And so when we think about it as a verb, then we are embracing the challenge of making community rather than finding community. But it also comes with the privilege of figuring out what that means for you. And that could be very simple, Melissa. It could be cooking for people and breaking bread together and allowing yourself to reminisce what it was like to deal with your hair as a child. You know, it can start from very simple places, but it really is about creating and making space for belonging and for being and for existing in all dimensions of as human beings, not just one.
Professor Garcia Pena, author of Community as Rebellion, thank you so much for joining The Takeaway today.
Thank you so much for having me.